Hi, everyone. I'm Candace, and I'm an alcoholic.
Candace.
So we have a thing in AA where we get asked to share our story, and it can be a scary thing to do, but it's a really good thing to do, and we're usually told not to say no. So I've never said no, and what the point of this is for me to share a little bit about what it was like and how I found AA and what AA has done for me. So my experience and my strength and hope is what I'll share with you tonight. I came in, my sobriety date is February 27th, 2012, so right at 5 years. And nothing prompted me to come in as far as any outside. I was not in any type of trouble. Which might have actually gotten me in sooner. But I kept experiencing, for about the last 4 years of my drinking, I kept experiencing great depression. And I would try to get sober on my own, and I could keep it for a little bit of time, but I could never sustain it. And each time that I would relapse, it wouldn't be long before I would be back, and the depression would be greater each time I relapsed. But I'll kind of digress and tell you a little bit about how it all started. I grew up in Florida to a single mother. I had a stepfather come into the picture when I was around 4 years old, and got a little sister when I was around six. Spent a lot of time alone, and my parents were very busy partying. The partying wasn't parties where they were social, but they were very preoccupied with themselves and their drinking. And so I spent a lot of time alone or a lot of time in daycare or with other family members. We moved around a lot, and that made for probably even more of a lonely childhood, because not only was there 6 years between myself and my sister, but moving around a lot, I would just begin to make friends, and then we would move again. I was sent back to live with my grandmother through most of my childhood. My mom could hold it together for a little bit, and then I'd be sent back to grandma's, and then I'd be pulled back, and she'd hold it together for a little while, and then I'd be sent back to grandma's. So my mother had a very difficult time, and it was primarily with alcohol. And we were pretty poor, and I spent most of my childhood wishing that I was not there, and that I could just live at my grandmother's full time. Where things felt normal and calm and peaceful and reliable. So that was my childhood. I didn't drink, or do I even remember my first drink? I didn't drink much in my high school years. I can remember being drunk maybe a handful of times before the age of 18, just a handful. My mother, although she drank, was incredibly strict And so I wasn't allowed to drink. I wasn't allowed to smoke. I wasn't really allowed to go outside much. I had to spend a lot of time indoors where she could watch me. I think it's because she felt safest that she could do her drinking if we were inside, and she knew where we were. So I didn't have a lot of freedom to experiment a lot or drink a lot. Until I was around 18, my senior year, is where I really kind of pushed the envelope on that. And I drank for about a year, but managed to go to school, managed to pass my classes. I didn't drink during the day, didn't drink during the week. So drinking was not, I felt nothing fantastic from it until I was much older. I met my husband in high school, and we got pregnant pretty early. And so at 19, I was pregnant. And by 20, I had our first child. And neither of us drank, ever, unless we were maybe at a wedding or a celebration. Might we have a glass of champagne or wine? And that was about the extent of it. So we raised three children. Between the age of 20 and 30 for me, I was very busy raising my kids. I was very happy. That was a beautiful time for me, and I didn't feel a lot of stress or pressure in raising children. So I don't recall really any drinking being an issue until I was around 30. And we moved into our third home, and that's when I can tell you that I can absolutely pinpoint without a shadow of a doubt getting drinking and knowing that it absolutely made me feel better. I was going to do it again. It made me feel a relief that I had never felt before, and I can pinpoint why. For me, it is very clear. We moved into like a country club community. I thought we had arrived. That is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be moving up and attaining more and more and more and more and more. And money, money, money. And we moved into this country club community. And as I mentioned, I grew up poor. So that was a real culture shock for me. And had not the slightest clue while we were purchasing the home what I was going to feel once we moved in. And moving in on that street was unlike anything I'd ever known or been around or seen. Everyone had Mercedes, and they were CEOs and sales execs, and all the women wore big diamonds and high heel shoes all day long, and didn't have to work. And that was not my reality. I worked. My husband and I had to work incredibly hard to attain that lifestyle. I was going to have to continue working for us to be able to live there. It just had not been my reality. And they had parties constantly. Just constantly, parties, parties, parties. And these women drank at every party. I had never seen drinking at Tupperware parties and Pampered Chef parties before. I had never experienced that, but these women drank every day, and they drank for every affair, and they spent their hours at the country club playing golf and having cocktails. And in between my working, if I could make it to anything, I would go, and they would put a glass of wine in my hand, and immediately I would feel relief. I did not feel comfortable in that environment. It was never anything that I had known to have women knock at the door and tell me they'd like to come in and help me decorate, or you know, I needed to make sure that my husband got me a bigger diamond. things of that nature. I'd just never seen it, not even on the TV, I guess. I just had no exposure to that. So I felt incredibly uncomfortable. I felt that I didn't fit in, which I'd always felt anyway. So that was extreme. How am I going to fit in? How am I going to make it? What should I wear to the bus stop? What should I wear to the party? Oh my gosh, what they were wearing to the pool. I mean, they were wearing high heels and their diamonds into the pool. It was just something. I immediately felt incredibly uncomfortable. I had always been a person that maybe I planted my own flowers. I didn't have a landscaper. I did my own laundry. I did not have someone coming in to do that for me. And all of these women did. So I began to drink. I didn't have the slightest clue. I never asked myself one time what that was going to do to me. I didn't stop. I just worked and would come home and pour a glass of wine and start cooking dinner and get the kids into bed and do what needed to be done. At around 34, so about 4 years into that drinking, my drinking began to take on a different life of its own. I started drinking almost every day, and instead of having a couple of glasses or three glasses, I began to have more like two bottles. It began to interfere with my ability to get up and go to work. I sold real estate. I started having a really hard time. I was hungover a lot. It definitely began to interfere. And so around 34, 35, I began that process of continuously kind of trying to stop, trying to curtail my drinking. And I would do that for the next 6 years. It was continuously, I battled depression. I was in therapy from, oh gosh, for probably 13 years, just constantly in and out of therapy, trying to understand why I was always depressed. And not until I was around 37 did I connect that in any way with the possibility that it could be my drinking. in any case, from 34 to 30, I'd say maybe 37, I drank almost every day. The only days that I didn't drink is when I was too hungover to drink. And I struggled tremendously. I would be up until 2 or 3 in the morning drinking, and would have a really hard time stopping. And I had to be up at 6 with kids to get them ready for school, drive them to school, drive clients around. So I was really struggling in life. I hid it. I would bring maybe one bottle into the house so that my husband could only see one bottle. And I would have 10 more in the trunk of my car. And I would head out to the car at midnight to grab two or three more bottles out. I was always hiding, and this never, I just had no clue. I just had absolutely no clue. I just knew that I couldn't stop and that I was always depressed. But beyond that, I didn't have much knowledge or intellect about drinking and behaviors and things like that that we do. If I ran out of booze, I would often text the women on my street at 10 or 11 at night, hoping that they hadn't gone to bed yet, and ask them if they could please put something outside for me, that I would pay them. I would be embarrassed about that the next day, but it didn't stop me. And no one ever said anything to me. So I bought booze from I bought wine. It was always wine from the neighbors on a pretty regular basis if I ran out of my stash. And if things got really dry and no one could sell me anything out their front door, I would wake one of my children up to drive me. So I definitely struggled with that and feelings of guilt the next day, that week. Those feelings were so of demoralization, were so strong for me that I would often feel suicidal, and that would lead me to try not to drink and to try to sober up and get a few months under me, thinking that that was all that I needed to do. And never once did I have any of my therapists suggest that maybe I was drinking too much. Nobody ever. And I would go in and tell them, I wake my child up to drive me to the liquor store. Is that okay? Because I feel really bad. They would say, oh my gosh, you're not driving, so that's good. I don't, it just wasn't in my journey. For anybody to tell me that maybe it wasn't a good idea how much I was drinking. And I began to spend a lot of time away from these women. My last 4 years of drinking, I did not drink much with them. And if I did, like if I was down at one of their parties until 1 a.m, I often had to ask them, for a couple bottles to take back home with me, because they were ready to go to bed and I was nowhere near done. So I could drink a lot and I didn't throw up, which is really odd. And a lot of times you have to get rid of some to keep going. Not for me. I just would just walk around till 4 and 5 a.m. just drinking. Really sitting on a porch is what I spent a lot of time doing, sitting on a porch and drunk dialing people. I was incredibly lonely. I remember it like yesterday, knowing like something's really wrong. I knew something was very, very, very wrong. Because nobody else drank the way that I did. And they were all in bed. And I had no desire to go to bed. And couldn't. Was never one of those drinkers that passed out or blacked out or had a few and got tired. I actually gained more energy and wanted, and I got more riled up. So if I was at a party, I was usually very silly and putting on a show and acting a fool and just crazy. So, in fact, I can remember being walked home on numerous occasions because I guess I was too far out for the crowd. About 2 years before I got sober, I was so severely depressed and suicidal that a therapist decided to send me to an addiction specialist. And I saw him for about 2 years before I would take his advice. Pretty much from the get-go, he explained to me that if I was feeling feelings of euphoria from taking a few sips, that wasn't normal. That normal people don't feel euphoria. And instantaneously, that blew my mind. I had never, ever heard it explained. And I knew, yes, that is me. I feel fantastic from just a few sips. And I know that I must have more, that feeling cannot stop. And he talked about AA with me for the next 2 years. But I wouldn't listen. To me, AA was For some reason, I thought people who went to AA had to have a brown bag in their hand and I guess be homeless on the streets. I was very, very, very afraid of going to AA. And so even though I saw him and seeked out his help for the next 2 years, I refused to go to AA. And he definitely, when they are addiction specialist, they often work with medications to, it's just how they work. So for 2 years, I took very strange drugs in the form of injections, subcutaneous injections that make you not crave. Sometimes they were oral medications, but most of the time they were injections that would make you not crave the alcohol and make you not feel the effects of it. I didn't think that odd at all. I thought that was just, oh, okay, sure thing. They weren't even FDA approved. They were in trial still, and I was in studies, you know. I, you know, don't know what, now, you know, I can just go, wow, how fun, wow, crazy, but then that was normal, and God knows what my poor husband, you know, had, what he must have thought. I would get these injections every 30 days, and they would go from one side, they usually would be in your rear. And so they could, you know, I would go, you know, here's my right side, here's my left side. I couldn't sit down. I got terrible infections in my rear, so I couldn't sit for like a year. I couldn't sleep. I mean, it was horrible, and I didn't even think that was odd. I was just like, well, I don't want to drink. This is great, you know. until my infections got so bad that my primary care physician was like, no, this is ridiculous. Like, no, this is not normal. What are you doing? I was like, well, I'm trying not to drink. And he was like, no, you have severe infections. Like, you cannot sit down. You're running fevers. Like, this is crazy. You can't get those anymore. And so I had to go back to my addiction specialist and tell him, look, they said I can't have this. What can we do? And he said, oh, okay, well, I'll give you the oral meds. Well, the oral meds didn't, they just, I don't know, the crave, they didn't help with cravings. And I actually was so insane with alcoholism that I realized I could actually drink more and not feel the effects. So then that just meant I could stay up later, I could drink more, I could taste. I loved the flavor of whatever I was drinking, so that meant I could drink more of it and accomplish more. And so then I spent, you know, about a year like that. And my last year of drinking was so insane that I often didn't sleep. I would drink till 6 and then just walk right into the kids' rooms and get them up and go, okay, it's time to get up, you know. And I'd hid the bottles so they couldn't find, you know, so nobody would know. And I'd take a shower and brush my teeth and march straight up to their room and get them up for school. Get them out the door and crash and be so completely hungover that I would sleep until 3 when they were walking through the door and get up and tell myself, oh my God, this is horrible. I'm so, you know, demoralized. I can't do this. And then by 5 o'clock, I'd have a glass of wine in my hand again. So I mean, it was, those last 6 months were insanity, for how much I was drinking. Because I couldn't feel it, and I sometimes would drink even 8 bottles of wine a night. I don't know how I didn't have a heart attack or a stroke, or I don't know how I didn't fall and hurt myself, but I could not feel the effects of it because of the medications that I was on, the drugs that my addiction specialist was giving to me. And I was so addicted. I could not stop. And I felt like I was on, the hamster wheel, and I could not get off, and I didn't know what else to do. And because of how this disease works and where it takes you, sometimes, it's to the depths of hell. And some of us end up in trouble, legally, and that's what saves us, and others of us end up suicidal. And what happened is I blacked out, which I rarely did. And my son, apparently I was rearranging furniture in the living room at 3:00 in the morning, and was just in a complete and total blackout. And my son watched this all, and apparently was mortified as I was falling all over the place and fell and hit my head on the fireplace and got back up and kept moving the sofa. And the next morning, he came to me, and I did what I always did, which was pretended. Everything's fine. I feel fine. It's fine. Here's your breakfast. Who needs coffee? What do I need to do? He approached me and asked me how I was feeling. I said, "I'm fine, honey. Everything's great. How are you?" And he was like, "No. How are you feeling? Do you remember anything?" And he was very upset with me. I could tell he was disgusted, and I had scared him. And so I had to go grab my husband and pull him back into the room and ask him what happened. And he said, "Well, you couldn't speak. You were talking, but it was no one understood what you were saying." And this went on for hours. And you were eating food directly out of the fridge, and which I did often. I would drink until I'd had my fill, and then I would gorge and be cooking food at 4 in the morning. And but I was usually not in a blackout, so I didn't do it in front of anyone. And then I would clean up and go get my shower. And get ready to take care of the kids. On this particular night, I was in a blackout, and I had no recollection of anything except for that I had a big bump on my head, and I knew that I must have hurt myself. And my husband explained to me what I had done, and I was just depressed enough and just demoralized enough that at that point, that sent me over the edge to know that I had upset him. And I remember I went and I laid back over the end of my bed, and I looked up at the ceiling fan, and I prayed for God to help me, that I didn't know what to do. And I had been praying a lot those last 2 or 3 months to God. In the middle of the night, as I'd be out in my trash can around the side of the house that was like this tall, so I would have to lay it down because I would forget that I was out of booze, and I would be like crawling in my trash can at 4 in the morning, or I would be crawling in the rafters in the attic because I was sure that I had hid some up there. I did very insane things that I'm sure I even gardened sometimes with flashlights out in the backyard because I could not sleep. So I'm sure my neighbors, I just did really strange things. Most people go to sleep, and I just couldn't. So I'd wake my kids up, and I'd have the attic stairs down, and they'd be like, "What are you doing?" And at 4 in the morning. And those last couple of months, because I could not stop, I literally could not stop anymore. There were no choices for me. It wasn't an option to stop. I couldn't figure out how to stop. I had begun to go into our closet and look at one of our guns that we kept in our closet. And I had begun to pick this gun up and to hold this gun. And I was really contemplating. a couple of nights prior to this blackout, I had stood at the top of my stairs leading down to my basement, and at the bottom of these stairs was stone. And I knew that if I could fall down those stairs in just the right way, because I'd looked at this gun enough times, and I couldn't bring myself to do it, and it would be too messy, and I didn't want the kids to wake up from the sound of it. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So I had begun this obsession with if I could fall down the stairs. And so I'd begun to actually pray to God, if he could let me fall down the stairs and break my neck, that would be a much easier way for the kids to find me. And that made total sense to me. So I would stand there with a glass of wine in one hand and a gun in the other and stare at the bottom of the stairs. And that's really where I was. And I'm really grateful that my son was upset with me, because that's what saved me. Didn't matter what any therapist said, or, you know, that I had been sent to an addiction specialist, or that I had infections from shots and injectables, and that I was severely depressed and contemplating suicide. Like, none of that mattered, but my son was upset with me. That mattered. And I prayed to God that morning, staring at that ceiling fan, tell me what to do. I don't know what to do anymore. And it was on that day that I decided I would go to AA. And I looked up online where a local meeting was that day, and walked into a meeting that night absolutely petrified, horrified of who I might see, who might be there, what might they think, what did we do? I had not the slightest clue what goes on in these rooms. And I still remember to this day where that meeting was. I remember faces from that meeting. It was a speaker meeting. And I remember what that man's story was. And his story was that he had accidentally killed his coworker. He worked on trains. And he was drunk at work. And had accidentally, he had moved something with one of those cars. And it killed his coworker instantly. And that blew my mind, that if this man could live with that and tell his story and be happy and have peace and be in this room, and God, that meeting was really big. There had to have been 75 to 100 people at that meeting. This was an old-timer telling his story, so he attracted a really big crowd, and that story just blew my mind. And I thought, if that man can get up at the front of this room and say that he had killed his coworker, but had been able to quit in AA and had found peace and happiness, that I had to try this. And so after that meeting was over, I remember that these women came over to me. I didn't even know what was going on, you know, when we go into our first meeting. We're like almost on autopilot. Like, what's happening? What am I doing? And these women came over and gave me their phone number and said, call me and keep coming back. And so that's just what I did. I came in and I just surrendered completely. I was absolutely horrified to come into these rooms, and every meeting I sat in the back. I came in as late as I possibly could, because I'm a really kind of a shy person, kind of quiet, and tend to kind of be solo, so it was really hard for me to imagine coming in or calling people or picking up the phone and asking anyone for help. Like, I could not imagine it, but I kept coming back. And that first year, I pretty much sat in the back of every meeting and cried, because I could not believe the stories that I was hearing and that I had done this to myself. It's how I looked at it. You know, some of us we're going to be so hard on ourselves. And that first year I spent just really in I wow, I think it was just being guided, is all I know to say, is I was being guided. I would hear people speak, and I would think, God, I'll never be able to do that. And I would hear people share in the meetings, and I would think, I will never be able to do that. Tell their stories, chair a meeting, say, you know, the preamble or do the prayers after. I just literally thought, I'll never be able to do any of that. And but I was so grateful to be there, and I just kept coming back, and I just trusted the journey. I just trusted it because I started feeling better and was able to stop drinking. I did exactly what I was told. I didn't ask. I was just like, fine, I'll do it. I'm so desperate. You know, I'll do it. I mean, my God, yesterday I was suicidal, so here, I'll do it. And they said, get a sponsor, and I did. And she said, do these steps, and I did. And she said, call me every day. And dude, I did. Oh, my God, call you every day. I don't even have anything new to say. I couldn't imagine any of that. It was very foreign to me. It was all very strange. But I thought, well, fine, I'll do it. Candace, you're going to come in, and you're going to make coffee, and then you're going to clean up the coffee afterwards, and you're not going to sit in the back. You're going to sit up here. And God, all of that was so strange to me, and it was, I think a lot of us, most of us probably, are pretty stubborn, and I just thought, wow, she's really far out, man, you know, I would, okay, though, fine, and I coasted through that first year, just so grateful. And it was probably around a year and a half in, I began to life hit, and we moved, and I began to struggle from the stress of the move. And what did I do? I took to the porch. I didn't drink, but I took to the porch. For some reason, I'm willed outside, always. Where I sat kind of frozen in a panic and a fear, afraid to move for about 9 months. I didn't go to meetings much, just a little bit here and there. I used, I think, about 4 or 5 temporary sponsors during that time because I thought it was a grand idea to let my sponsor go. It was a rough 9 months, and definitely taught me that my own, left to my own will, I am self-will run riot. Like, if I make my own decisions, man, it's not going to be good. And I struggled and suffered, and I mean suffered, on that porch for 9 months. And a friend who is in this room tonight, by the grace of God, called and needed a ride to go pick his car up. I think he was purchasing a new car and needed a ride there. And he could just hear it in my voice that something was very, very, very wrong. And just told me, you're going to a meeting tonight. You're going to a meeting, and I'm getting you a sponsor tonight. And get you, do you need a ride? Do I need to come get you, actually? And just pretty much pushed me and forced me. And I came to a meeting here and was introduced to my sponsor and told, this is who you're working with. And it was definitely grace, because I was severely depressed again. So, I mean, we can become severely, you know, I mean, we can just go right back to our old thinking and our old ways if we don't keep coming. So that's why we're told, you know, keep coming, so that hopefully that habit develops. Because if our own... If left to our own will, you know, it's more often than not that we'll leave and we'll think, I've got this, or I'm fine on my own, or see, I can sit on this porch for 9 months and not drink. I'm suicidal again, but I don't need a meeting. I mean, I can think the most insane thinking thoughts on my own. And this time around, even though I didn't drink, I was in so much pain that had God not given me, had God not shown me the grace to give me a sponsor that was like, no, you're coming to this many meetings and you're going to call me this many times, and if you want me to work with you, this is what we're going to be doing. And that, you know, was my savior. These rooms, that person who called me that night, being from this room. I mean, there's so much grace in what these rooms has, you know, has done for me. The knowledge that I can't do this on my own, and that I don't ever want to feel that way again. And if it means I have to come into these meetings, you know, every week, then fine, I'll do it. I'm so grateful to be sober and to not have to turn to alcohol to cope. Working with others has been the absolute gift. I get out of my head. I had no idea that picking up the phone, my sponsor told me you're going to start calling people. I literally thought I was going to die. I mean, I just thought I'm going to die. Like, you're flipping kidding me, right? Like, I'm going to call this woman I do not know. I just saw her across the room. What are you talking about? Wow, what a gift. I mean, even if that person can only talk for 5 minutes, that's 5 minutes I got out of my head and listened to her. If she is, you know, new, to get to walk with her through this journey, to understand, you know, what that person is feeling and be there for someone else because I've walked it and I understand the fear. And how much that fear runs us, you know, it can just take us over, and we don't know that fear is running us. I'm not running me. Fear is running me. So then I'm not even really me. And you know, it's an amazing journey. If we can hold on, and it doesn't always happen, you know, overnight. Some people take these steps, and, you know, in that third step, they have, you know, a white lightning experience when finding their higher power and choosing to let go. I didn't. Mine was a slower process, and because I'm so stubborn and think that my way is better, I couldn't be more grateful. The fact that I can get up in front of you all and share and talk, and I don't practice. I don't think much about it. I just get up here and I do it. And to come into these, to find a home group, to begin sponsoring women, to work the steps, not in my way, but in the way that they're suggested. I mean, they are suggestions, and we all, you know, we all have our own journeys. So how we find these steps is a part of each of our own individual journey. They are suggestions. However, they're suggestions for a really specific reason, because they work best done that way. And to get a home group where I'm responsible every week for showing up, for doing my part, for still, if you know, making coffee, greeting people at the door, calling people, getting out of my head, calling my sponsor, doing step work, I still do them. I hope that there never comes a day where I choose not to do them. I hope and pray that on a regular basis. I definitely don't know if I have this. I don't think, I'd never walk around with the thought of, oh, I've got this now. Oh, see, you know, I can speak in front of people, so I figured it out. I walk around thinking, please, God, don't ever let there come a day. You know, where I'm struggling so bad that I forget how important it is to keep coming back to my meetings, and not just once a month, but every week. And because it has saved my life. It has saved my life. It has gotten me through some very difficult times. To have the same faces and the same people, and becomes your family, your tribe. And it's been crucial for me. There's a couple of things I thought I would share that really stand out for me. That I do. It's been a long journey for me. It's been really hard for me to begin meditating. But, you know, in the big book, they say to meditate. And that can be so hard to begin that process. Because it's so hard for us to quiet our minds and to shut down. You know, even for 1 minute, you know, or 4 minutes, just... if there's any way that you can try that, that you can start that. And there's an app called Headspace that is incredibly helpful. Also, you know, I do a lot of stuff, just iPods, I mean, on my iPods, where you listen to stories, where you listen, like, constantly listening to people tell their story. I probably have 100 CDs that Damon has made, and I listen to them in my car all the time. So I highly suggest that, just kind of saturating, you know, yourself with stories of inspiration, people who have a really good, strong program. I definitely have never played again on the playground. It was a hard thing to do. It is a lonely thing when you drop the playground of your drinking friends. It can all be very frightening. But I highly suggest not trying to keep playing with that or with your friends that still drink. It's very hard. It's just so tempting. And that was only doing it over and over and over on my own, realizing I just can't play over there anymore. So I do credit that to being a way that I've been able to stay sober, is just saturating myself with the people in these rooms, the stories from these rooms, and a lot of inspiration. I read every day, and books that are from AA or AA approved, where I read like a daily meditation or a daily word. Most all rooms have grapevines in them, and you can have those emailed to you. I get emailed every day, and so I thought that I would share with you guys the quote of the day, which I thought was pretty good. Today is March the 2nd, and today it says, "I have enough to do just to live my life today. I can show my love for others best if I let them live theirs too." I'm sorry, that wasn't the grapevine. That was a little meditation book. And I do these every day, guys. I literally get up early to specifically do my readings to set my day off, where I'm making conscious contact at the beginning of my day, not at the end, but at the very beginning, to surrender, to ask God for help and for guidance, and to not run on my will, but to run on his. The Grapevine quote was, "I started to understand that while I didn't believe in churches, I had to see that something or someone was working in my life that hadn't been there before." And I thought that was really beautiful for me today, for me specifically, as I've never been a big church-going person or a religious person. And if you're not, I know sometimes it can feel really tough coming in and talking about God or hearing people talk about God. But those are things that I do every morning. And then I thought I would close with a poem that found me in my first year, and I do believe it found me. And I read it often. I keep it on my phone. I look at it frequently. It just spoke to me because in sobriety, life can feel tough. Life hits, and you feel stress, and you've got to cope and figure out how to cope without drinking. And to surrender to the journey can be really hard because feelings are tough to feel. And this found me my first year in, and I thought it was really beautiful because it was exactly how I felt, like I was on a new journey. And it was frightening. "For a seed to achieve," this is by Cynthia Ocelli. "For a seed to achieve its greatest expression, it must come completely undone. The shell cracks, its insides come out, and everything changes. To someone who doesn't understand growth, it would look like complete destruction." And that really spoke to me because I felt at times I didn't know who I was and what was happening and what were all of these new feelings and thoughts. Who was I and who was I becoming? And I found this and I thought, wow, that's what's going on. Is I'm just trying to achieve my greatest expression. And so to believe in the journey and to trust in the journey. And every one of us here has been willed here by something greater than ourselves. There's a purpose for it. And just trust it. Thanks. Thanks.